Welcome to the Experience Points Podcast, episode 81 for June 9th, 2010.
Quick warning, this podcast contains spoilers for Bioshock 2.
Welcome back to the Experience Points Podcast. I'm Scott Juster.
I'm George Alborn.
We are the co-creators of experiencepoints.blogspot.com, a site we created and dedicated to the serious but not humorless analysis of video games and culture. Mm-hmm. And today, third seat. Got a third seat with us. Yeah. We have Andrew Vandenbosch. Andrew, hi.
Hi, guys.
Hey, how's it going?
Andrew, why don't you introduce yourself for the folks that may not have read you or talked to you before?
And I'm sure there are many. My name's Andrew, and I write a biweekly column called Design Diversions for Game Set Watch, specifically Game Set Watch. It also runs on Game of Sutra and Game Career Guide, I guess, but I don't know if anyone reads that.
Multiple times we've used Andrew's articles to riff on for podcasts.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Hopefully I haven't said anything too terrible about them.
Yeah, we apologize.
Oh, it's quite all right. It's really wonderful to have people actually, like, talking about my stuff. I was beyond flattered when I found that you guys were talking about it.
Well, I like to start off the podcast with a little love fest. I guess before we jump into the article that we're doing this week, I guess we ask people who are on the podcast a little bit about their personal gaming history, a little bit the way that they view video games. Because obviously you love video games if you write about them. If you spend your time writing about them and also maybe make a couple pennies here and there on them.
Or are we wrong? Do you hate video games?
How'd you get into... What games have been the most influential to kind of get you into this more critical sphere of writing?
Let's see. I'm trying to think of what... got me into writing about them. Mm-hmm. Actually, Leah Alexander's column that was on Game Set Watch, Sexy Video Game Land, was pretty much like the major inspiration for me, like wanting to write a column. Mm-hmm. But in terms of video games themselves, I recently had to say what my three favorite video games were for some website. And
of all time, wow.
Of all time. Yeah, no, it's got a lot of pressure, and I really like it's kind of silly, but you know, you can get a good sense of what people value in games with it. So I'll go ahead. I think my favorites are probably Half-Life 2.
Mm-hmm. Good choice.
I think it's so well paced and so atmospheric, even though I really hate the silent protagonist.
Oh yeah.
I also love to hate video games, so
that's why I brought you here today.
Yeah,
make us feel good. It'll be great.
And Ico, I really have to say, because it's...
Amen.
It's just, I think that Ico speaks to sort of like what I value the most in video games, is that they can create this atmospheric experience.
Yep.
And I think that that's where the real strength of the medium lies. Maybe not necessarily in narrative, although there's a lot of narrative potential. Mm-hmm. But just that experience of being there, of an emotional, of creating these organic emotional connections with...
Another basically silent protagonist, huh?
Yeah. Weird. Although he talks in that
gibberish
that they use for that.
Yeah.
But again, it's like, that's exactly what I mean, because it's so evocative. Like, even though you can't understand what they're saying, you can understand sort of the feeling behind it.
Yeah.
Like, get the hell over here, Yoda.
Exactly. Like, stop staring at those birds, honey. The last one would be the Final Fantasy Legend. It's this really old Game Boy game.
Yeah. It was kind of a... if I remember it correctly, it's kind of a Secret of Mana-esque style game, right? Like adventure?
Yeah, that's a Final Fantasy adventure.
Oh, okay.
And it actually was... They changed the name. It's actually the first Secret of Mana game.
Got it.
They changed the name for the American release.
Mm. And again, is that a game where it was like atmosphere that brought you in to starting to think about how, you know, the video game was working?
Yeah, it's really unusual for an RPG in that it's almost like a short story collection, because you go from one world to another through this tower, and each of them has their own completely self-contained storyline. Mm. So it doesn't have the same sort of like epic narrative that most other video games or most other RPGs would have. So it's got a lot of like, and there are these like little side worlds in between.
So it's like Quantum Leap of JRPGs, would you say?
Yeah, it's almost, you know, like you're going from like one scenario to another. It's weird. Like I've never played an RPG that didn't have that sort of like, that didn't have like a save the world type.
I think it's interesting and a great segue into the article that we're talking about today, which is Ethics 101, Designing Morality in Games. J. Matthew Zoss wrote this on Gamma Sutra. Mm-hmm. He talked to Bethesda's Emil Pagliarulo, sorry about that, Emil, and also Jordan Thomas from 2K Marin. And this is about moral choices in games. And I think it was interesting that all three of those games that you cited don't really do a huge thing about making the player choose something, you know, explicitly moral, like something like BioShock would do. And yet, you know, you had a pretty big reaction to this article. You know, you were the one that actually brought it to our attention, so we decided to have you on mm-hmm. the show to help us through this thing. I guess starting out, what hooked you with this article? Like, what got you kind of engaged with what they're trying to do morally? Because I know you felt pretty strongly about it.
Yeah, well, I think the article reflects sort of how I think Western developers are tending to think about morality systems, mm-hmm. which is that I feel like there's this sort of tendency to feel as if they want to make their game not to really like give players a few separate like storylines, but the idea is that the player, if they give these moral choices, a player can like sort of create their own perfect game by like following their sort of natural tendencies. Mm-hmm. And I guess what really struck me about the article is at the end, that final thing that they say where they're talking about how the majority of people didn't pick the evil options.
Yeah.
And they were really interested like that. It seemed almost that they were sort of proud that people were, you know, wanted good. To be good. Mm-hmm. But to me, that sort of, it seems like it's a problem.
Yeah.
The majority of people aren't interested in half of their game. And it just made me wonder is it actually a good thing? Mm-hmm. People don't want to choose
the quote unquote bad option.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like that makes you should say anything about your true character, you know, it should just be another interesting option, another experience, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, are we that good at making evil characters interesting? I mean, the games that I can recall that I've chosen to take a path that I wouldn't normally do as a decent human being, of course.
Yeah.
Just tend to be not very interesting.
Are you thinking of a certain?
Well, Fable in particular comes to mind.
That you were pretty much good, you know.
No, I was evil. I was.
Oh, you were
evil. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, like killing. You know, if I could kill children, I probably would have. it was just it's not very fun.
One thing that I run into is that people, I think, are afraid of missing content. Was that what made it feel unsatisfying for you, George?
I'm not quite sure what you mean.
You mean, like, you're locked out of the good guy paths and quests and stuff if you choose evil.
Yeah.
And is that why you found it unsatisfying? Because you thought maybe the good is, like, the supposedly true way of playing?
Yeah, I guess I always have in mind that the developers have in mind what they want the story to be.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And I think that plays out, you know, if you were to look at even something like BioShock, I don't think that the hook and the conclusion to the first BioShock, if you go the killing the little sisters route, is all that compelling. I think they had in mind the good story because that's what people are used to telling.
Mm-hmm.
So absolutely.
It's just an institutional thing. I mean, our first video games were never about the bad guy.
Yeah.
We were always the good guy, and maybe we're like historically just kind of stuck in that mode, and so the prized narrative becomes the good path.
I think that there's also a tendency of game designers to sort of be, I think, a little bit afraid of mm-hmm. letting players get away with being too evil. Hmm. Like you mentioned, you can't, like, they deliberately made it so you couldn't kill children in Fable.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you guys played Infamous, but mm-hmm. if you try and... That was a game in which I picked the evil route, not because I really felt like it, but just because I wanted to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And in Infamous, you've got this ex-girlfriend who you start the game basically breaking up with her. So you've never had any real development of her.
Mm-hmm.
Every time you do something evil, she comes in with this really nagging voice saying, "Be so bad! Like, you can't believe how what a jerk you are." And you spend the whole game with a character keeping on, he keeps on trying to pursue her, but she keeps on saying, like, you know, "Well, you're like too evil for me to like you."
Huh.
And at a certain point, I was just so fed up with that. I was like, you know, why are you berating me so much for being bad? It's not like I wanted to be bad. It's like you guys made this evil route and you said it would be fun.
But would that have been ameliorated if you had a relationship with her? Like if they would have just started the story before you broke up?
If there was like a reason for her
nagging? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think that would have made a big difference. And I think that maybe, I feel like she almost exists solely as this moralizing voice rather than an actual person.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that, you know, like not developing a character is the easiest way to make somebody not interested in them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it also makes it, you know, but it makes me feel a little bit like, you know, did they put Trish in this game for the sole purpose of nagging the player?
Because
it feels more like the player's being nagged than the protagonist. And I feel like that there is a difference between this electrically shooting person and myself.
I think that's also a problem of a game like Infamous 2, where your character is basically a stand-in for the player because they're nothing until the player takes control of them. Right. Like, you have to give this player a moral compass because there's, like, a little moral compass meter.
Right, exactly.
Whereas, you know, Wander in Shadow of the Colossus already has a set of ideas of what he wants to do, and the player's just kind of helping him complete that. The guy in Infamous is just nothing. Like, he could be good or bad, and so anything that he does is inherently a reflection on the player choices, right?
Yeah, definitely.
I think that's where, you know, sometimes it gets fuzzy, and I think it succeeds maybe less when we start putting the moral decision-making in the hands of the player as opposed to in the hands of the character through the player, if that makes sense at all.
Yeah. No,
I mean, at some point, especially if the game is preaching and saying, you know, if you make bad moral decisions, you're a bad person, if they're judging the player as opposed to the character as a character. Because to some extent, you know, if we've got Shadow of the Colossus, or maybe a better example would be Ico, a single-player story in which the character, not of your decision-making, makes moral decisions.
To help this girl.
To help this woman. Yeah. And it succeeds, and it has a great dramatic effect.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the player's. And so when the player makes the moral decision, we're put in this place now where the dilemma is in my hands and not in the hands of the perceived character.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, maybe Mass Effect 2 might be a good one. I, as a player who's playing Commander Shepard, have doubts about whether or not I need to do a certain action.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially in, like, the loyalty quests.
Mm-hmm.
And that might not be the case for the Shepard. Once I make my decision, that character, as a person within the world, has no doubts.
Yeah.
You know, like, the character in Infamous, who's evil, it may just be through and through evil and not be having any moral decisions at all. Mm-hmm. But the player is the one to have these moral decisions.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's the difference between, like, what I would consider, like, directing a character as a player and just inhabiting the player. And just inhabiting the character as an actor. Like, sometimes you'll make a choice as Shepard and it'll be like, oh, you know, this will be the good choice or the to offer condolences or something. And he'll say it really awkwardly. Like, I would have never said it like that. Why did you do that? But you're just kind of the director and you're seeing what the actor's going to do with it.
Yeah, no, I think that's actually a really good way of putting it, that you're sort of a director and then you've got like this character who's a very different person from you, and you have this, the relationship between the two of you, I think, is something that's not really well understood.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, like with a character like, I mean, even a character like Cole is more developed and living than like Gordon Freeman or something like that.
Yeah.
And so as a player, you can make choices in this game, but like, do you also have to consider like, you know, what this character actually would choose? Like what sort of person they are?
The motivation, yeah.
Yeah, like what's their motivation? And a lot of times I find myself wondering, like, am I supposed to do what I want, or am I supposed to imagine what I would do? We'll say, like, in Bioshock 2, which I recently finished, should I just make what I think is right? Or considering the fact that I'm this genetic mutant in this big daddy suit. Mm. What would he do, you know?
Yeah.
So what do you usually decide then in that case?
And when I was playing Bioshock 2, I felt like, I don't know, I felt myself getting a little bit more into that character. I don't know exactly why. Mm-hmm. I ended up like not killing any, you know, when you have those options to kill those people.
Mm-hmm. Actually, neither one of us has played Bioshock 2, I mean, I don't know. I'm kind of, I really want to know because they talk about Bioshock 2 a lot in the article as much deeper than Bioshock 1 as far as the choices. Mm-hmm. Did you find it that way?
I didn't find it much deeper, but...
just slightly deeper, a couple inches.
Slightly deeper.
I mean, you're already underwater, so yeah. How deep can you get?
Bioshock is much deeper. One of the... So the only thing that they've really added to it is that... So you still have the little sisters,
mm-hmm.
but you've also got these three people who come along in the course of your story, and you have the option of... to kill them or to not kill them. And so there's actually like, I think there's like four or six different endings.
Mm-hmm.
And they depend on like how many little sisters you rescue.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another factor that changes depending on whether you kill these people or not. I think what I actually liked the most about Bioshock 2 is how, so you're like supposed to, you're trying to save this girl who's like the little sister to your big daddy.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, she actually turns into one of the big sisters.
Whoa, ooh. Yeah.
Yeah, so she actually, and she gives you this plasmid that, like, summons her. So she's actually fighting with you for the last level of the game.
Wow, that sounds awesome.
Yeah, it's actually really cool. The other thing that she does is she starts to make decisions. You don't have any more choices after a certain point.
Uh-huh.
And she makes her decisions based on how you made your decisions.
Oh, okay.
That's cute.
Yeah, it's neat, because she's like, I'm going to do what daddy does.
Slices someone's head off.
Exactly. So if you were, like, killing people left and right, she's definitely going to, like...
Mm-hmm.
So the last boss of the game, actually, or Lamb, who's the person who...
Yeah.
Who's, like, the Andrew Ryan of this game, whether or not she lives or dies depends on if you spare these people or not.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really interesting because I really wanted Lamb to die that whole time.
As a person or as the character you were playing as?
As both, because she's like this. She's crazy. She's sanctimonious. She's like incredibly self-righteous.
Mm-hmm.
But since I spared these people's lives, the little sister who you save at the end decides, okay, well, I'm going to forgive her.
Hmm.
Even though I, as the player, didn't feel like forgiving her.
Mm-hmm.
But it actually seemed pretty cool to me because she made the like morally right decision where I would have made the morally wrong decision.
Did the game have quantitative rewards for going one way or the other?
It didn't, which was a nice thing about that, mm-hmm. that separated it from the little sister.
Would you agree then? I think it was Emil suggesting that we should remove moral decisions from quantitative rewards.
You know, it's a really good point, and it's sort of... I don't know if there's a clear answer at all to that, actually. Yeah.
I think the guy from Bethesda mentions, the quote is, concrete gain is the root of any conflict of interest, and therefore we shouldn't.
Yeah, I mean, I am kind of partial to that argument because I'm a big fan of consequence, I guess. And if you want to pursue a certain route, you have to deal with the consequences. Like, one of the most irritating things about the first Bioshock was that regardless of whether or not you save or harvest the little sisters, you can basically get the same loadout at the end.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no real gameplay difference.
You don't really know that until someone tells you that.
Well, you can start doing the math in your head, like, you know, oh, that teddy bear gave me this much, and those sisters combined gave me this much. Like, oh, almost nothing.
But that presumes that you've killed some sisters mm-hmm. to be able to have the data to measure that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess in that case, if a player goes either... kills all the little sisters
mm-hmm.
or doesn't kill any of the little sisters,
mm-hmm.
then they might perceive their actions as not being equal.
Mm. Yeah.
Because yeah. I never killed a sister. And from the beginning, I felt that I was probably getting less Adam
mm-hmm.
than I would have gotten. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I still made that moral decision knowing that I was suffering a tangible loss.
Mm-hmm. So basically it's just the perception of loss then. Right? It's just the perception of a possible...
Yeah, but I don't even think we need that. I mean, I think that tying to rewards could be really effective.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah. You know, to some extent, moral dilemmas don't always have answers. We don't always know what's going to come of it.
Yeah.
You know? Something I think is cool in Mass Effect 2 is the number of decision-making in the game, particularly during the loyalty quests, that you know, it might come up again in Mass Effect 3, but yeah. We don't know the outcomes yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and some of the decision-making in Mass Effect 2 is very hard. You know, there were times when I had to stand up and think about, like, okay, what might happen in the future,
mm-hmm.
and how are the characters going to react immediately?
Mm-hmm.
And you start weighing decisions based upon data you don't have.
Yeah, and I feel like that's where things get really interesting and where all those little minute decisions become really important. And in a game like BioShock, I feel like there's just so few decisions that you make and their impact is so relatively minor. That it's hard to kind of like with Mass Effect, you have like little choices that cascade into like huge differences, mm-hmm. even between these games, where like your entire like this the new game starts in a completely different way. Whereas I feel like that sort of moral decision making becomes a lot more trivial when you only make like, you know, in BioShock 2, you only make like 3-4, I guess, if you count whether you're gonna harvest little sisters or not.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know like how effective that is, or even like if it matter, like, you know, what are players getting out of those moral choices in a game like BioShock 2 or BioShock that they couldn't get out of the game without it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And do you think that it devalues the moral choice or the ethical dilemma if it is presented to the player as such?
Like hey, decision making.
Yeah,
time.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, like I played Dead Space a while ago and I noticed I could stomp on the corpses of dead people to prevent them from turning into zombies, and I was like, oh, that's kind of a really fucked up thing to do. Like, but I'm gonna do it anyway because I think the benefits outweigh and I think I'm morally justified in doing it. But like, that was, it wasn't something presented to me as decision time. Are you gonna be a desecrator of the dead, or are you gonna, you know, bury them?
Yeah.
Or, you know, shoot them out the airlock? So like, Have you had some kind of moral decision that the game didn't prompt you on?
You know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because the Final Fantasy Legend definitely did that for me.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so games where the last, or especially Japanese games, where the last boss is God,
mm-hmm.
is almost a cliche by now. But back then, it was something that I wasn't expecting, and it really comes out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the game, like, you sort of, like, your characters have been, like, trying to reach paradise this whole time. And then you, like, you meet up with the creator of the world who's like, you know, I made all of these demons. And it's really cool that you beat him because I wanted somebody to, like, overcome. It was refreshing to see people overcome evil. And it's got this great thing where it's, like, he's, you know, so it's the god of the game world, but it almost seems like he's, like, the game designer.
Mm-hmm.
Saying, like, you know, wasn't it fun to, like, kill all those monsters?
That's weird.
And then the characters decide that they're going to fight him. When I played that game, I was, like, 11, and it was, like, a really big deal to me.
Mm-hmm.
I remember having to, like, turn off the game and, like, and decide whether or not it was, like, an okay thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, at like, you know, there's no decision to be made really there. Like, the game is linear.
Yeah, you can either stop playing or do it.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. And that's the only decision that you get. And I think that probably the most interesting thing about it is that without presenting in the game this, like, moral decision time,
mm-hmm.
they were able to provoke those thoughts within me and make me think about the choice, mm-hmm. even though there was really no choice to make.
Yeah.
You know, they could have done that in a book, you know, where you, like, a book is linear, you know, but you do have the choice to stop reading it.
Very much like the newest Prince of Persia game, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, the ending is kind of like that.
In my book, would you say Pokemon counts?
Well,
I mean, so one of my earlier playthroughs of Pokemon, I would release the Pokemon that I decided I wouldn't use again.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, I thought it was a little unethical to be collecting them all. I know it's ostensibly the goal.
Yeah, yeah. But, gotta catch them all.
That's one of them.
That's really cool. I like that.
The other I would say was, and they mentioned in the article, the Far Cry 2. The decision of whether or not to save your friends, and I guess not really friends, but your mercenary cohorts, with your Sorettes, you know, at first it's something that it's very clear-cut. And then towards the end of the game, in my opinion, it's also clear-cut. You generally don't want to save them, or mm-hmm. it doesn't really matter if they die.
Mm-hmm.
But in the middle, there's some really interesting decision-making going on. one of the more memorable moments in the game was I had one Surette, and I was really low on health, and my pal was dying on the ground, and I made the decision to, you know, inject it into myself, mm-hmm. and I was like, I'll come back. Just wait here. I'll kill all the bad guys. I'll come back to you. And I got lost, and I couldn't find his body, and he just, it said missing.
Uh-huh.
And that was really dramatic, because I didn't know that the choice I was making at the time was between, you know, myself and certain death. I didn't know what the outcome could possibly be.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's really clear cut and says, you know, you're choosing A, you're choosing B, it's generally easy enough to say, well, you know, those are my options.
You can weigh your options easily and make a informed opinion.
I think that the Far Cry 2 presumed, I think, that either I save him, because essentially you're given two options, either give the Surette to your dying friend or shoot him and put him out of his misery.
Yeah.
I chose a third option, which is give myself the Surette, go try to find one and come back.
Mm-hmm.
That turned out to be a bad decision because my friend ended up dying. But, you know, it was my own decision.
Yeah.
And it was something that happened on the fly.
And that's where I think, it almost feels like morality, you know, explicit moral decisions, like, okay, decision time, or like a morality meter, is almost, maybe it's almost a gimmick or a passing fad or something, because it doesn't necessarily conform to, like, one, how other mediums do explorations of ethical decisions and morality, and two, it doesn't really inspire the player to kind of come to any decision organically. It's nice to have, you know, will you be bad or evil? You know, you can get a clear view of maybe what you're going to play through in the coming hours, but, right. You know, what is it really asking you? It's just asking you to kind of choose an option rather than to form an opinion, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that, like, to be honest, there's definitely a reason why we keep on seeing these morality systems. And I think it's because it's just so recognizable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you want to present that your game has two aspects to it, good and evil is, like, what could be possibly more recognizable and polarizing than that? It's a sort of, like, basic tenet of game design to let your players know, like, you know, what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Like you were saying with, like, Mass Effect, sometimes when you choose a dialogue option, it's a lot more awkward than you think it is.
Yeah.
But when they have, like, Paragon and Renegade, you need at least know that, well, no matter what he says, at least he's going the Paragon option.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This idea of what that means. So my intentions as a player are going to be reflected correctly by my choices.
Yeah.
But
I mean, don't you think that part of it stems from a fear we'll just alienate people if they make decisions they don't end up liking? Mm. I mean, at some point, doesn't it seem like we're coddling players who want to be able to say, oh, I didn't want to do that. I want to go back. That's not really the way dramatic moral decisions happen.
Yeah.
You know, you don't get to do it again.
Definitely. And I think that's why, you know, designers have to be really careful with stuff like this, because, you know, if you don't like the choice that you made, you can just restart the game or reload from your last save.
Mm-hmm.
So not only do you have to make, like, compelling moral decisions, which may have unforeseen consequences that the player may not like, but you need the player to feel like they haven't screwed themselves over and that it's such a bad decision that they want to restart it. Or at least
one of the things that could combat that is simple. Like, games are so long and so involved. If you decide that you made a choice that's going to screw up the next 20 hours of your life and your weekend hours and everything, like, you don't want something that could possibly mess you up. Like, but if a game like this isn't very similar to something like Bioshock, but a game like Sleep is Death, where it seems like the little vignettes that players create together don't last that long. But they are, like, free to go crazy and explore during those vignettes, because the consequences are not going to be, you know, Mass Effect 3 is going to be screwed up because you made the wrong choice in Mass Effect 2.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that players can accept all sorts of horrible stuff happening if they don't feel like, you know, the implications of their choice are going to resonate through, like, not just, like, one game, but three.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like, oh my God, like, what am I going to have to sit through?
Yeah.
But the sort of thing where it's like, you can make the choice and you can and screw up, but then you have the chance to replay it again. I think that,
and that's, I think, like, the fundamental power of video games, right? Experimenting within a certain system,
mm-hmm.
knowing that you can experiment.
And I think that players will be more than happy to make mistakes if they know that they can, you know, it's not a chore to restart and see what things are going to be like if they made a different choice.
True. But I mean, ideally, even the bad decisions aren't going to turn out to make the game suffering, you know, make you suffer through it.
Mm-hmm. The game should be sort of, you know, horrible things may happen, but the game should at least be equally fun no matter what you pick, you know?
It's hard, I think, because people have this ideal in their head, right? Like, they want Rex through Mass Effect 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah.
And it's not that the game will be quantitatively worse, but for them, it will be qualitatively less pleasant for them, right? Because if they lose that character. And they're supposed, you know, we've been trained to think that video games are a world that we control.
Yeah.
And so if you take that away by implementing something where a character is just wiped out.
We're so entitled.
Well, no, I think it is. Like, I think morality meters essentially are about entitlement. Like, you are trying to measure how good or how bad you are, and you feel entitled to know exactly how people look at you.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, maybe people like you, maybe they don't, but you'll never know unless they tell you.
Yeah. But I don't really want to be looked at. So, I mean, look at something like Fallout 3 that measures your, instead of having, you know, one or two very dramatic moments, although those are definitely there, they measure your morality in various ways throughout the entire game. And some of it is, you know, reputation-like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you won't be able to get certain individuals in your team unless you are good enough or bad enough.
Yeah.
But when you steal things, you get a little negative morality thing pops up, even when no one is watching.
That's weird, though. That's so, just like the panopticon. Like, there's some weird force. Like, if I stole something from you and no one knew but me, how... Like, morality is inherently social.
Yeah, but that's what they're saying, right? Is it's not. Like, a bad thing is a bad thing, whether or not anyone's there to see it.
That's weird. I find that odd.
No, it's really interesting that you can't, like... There aren't very many games that let you act like a good person but be evil on the inside, you know? That would be fun.
I mean, even Fable, like, when you're bad, you've got horns, your face just ripples with, like, satanic powers.
There was, you know, before we wrap it up here, there was this, I don't know if you listened to the Idle Thumbs podcast, but they were talking about Gordon Freeman in this respect, and how, you know, he's, what if Gordon Freeman wasn't just a blank slate for players? Like, what if he was actually a dude that, like, never talks, and the people in the game know that he never talks?
Like, he's mute?
Yeah, he's just, like, this crazy psychotic guy who guns down people and aliens indiscriminately, but never says anything to anyone else in the world.
He is a scientist. I mean, what do we expect, right?
And so it's like that. That's what you would have. Like, you'd have this player that, you'd have this character that doesn't really care whether or not things are moral or not. They're just kind of going through life as a sociopath.
Yeah. real quick, what do you guys think about the possibilities for moral decisions in multiplayer games? I know they mentioned Army of Two, 40th Day.
Yeah.
As a potential?
Have you played that one, Andrew?
No, I haven't. I tried playing the demo, but it didn't have local co-op or something. No, it didn't have single player. I couldn't get my girlfriend to play it with me.
George and I, we played the demo, right?
We played the demo, yeah.
I'm pretty sure we came to one of those moral dilemmas, but I immediately pulled the trigger to kill a dude.
Well, so that's the interesting thing, is when the moral decision happens, and it's obvious because you get a little prompt on the screen, whichever of the players presses the button first, that action occurs, whether or not the other person wanted it.
Yeah.
So then you get, like, moral, I don't know, conflict at some point, where you go, why did you shoot that man? Or, you know,
I think that's actually more true to how our decisions work, because it's not like we're coming into games with a blank slate and we learn the game's moral system. Like, we're coming in with certain expectations just by living in a society.
Yeah.
And so, like, we know that we can kind of intuit that stealing is probably going to ding us, because stealing is also wrong in our external worlds.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a cool way to do it multiplayer, because you're just taking what constructs our morality, which is other people, and, you know, putting it as part of the game. And the game isn't even doing anything. You're just using the tools that you have outside to make the choice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm sure people make different decisions depending on who they're playing with.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
I remember reading about some guy who, his girlfriend got really mad at him when he was harvesting the little sisters while playing Bioshock. So he, like, couldn't take that route because she was judging him. So it's just really interesting how, like, you know,
it's amazing how even one extra person in the room could completely change how you play the game.
There's a cute story of someone, their little son was watching them play Grand Theft Auto, so he would just obey all the traffic laws, and I'd drive really slowly, and it was just an exploration game.
That's so cute.
Okay, well, before we wrap it up, is there any final thoughts you want to add in? Like, maybe, like, what you would be excited to see going forward, like a hypothetical game, or maybe a game that you're looking forward to that's going to tackle something like ethical decision-making?
You know, one thing that I really want to see more of is decisions that aren't, that are based on something other than good and evil.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, like the sort of visual novel thing with the Japanese games is to like have like different paths for different like heroines. They're able to tell like a whole bunch of different stories that way. So it'd be, I guess I'm more interested in saying like, you know, rather than the good or evil, if you could organize multiple stories over something different like that, I'd like to see like three or four different ways of going through the game that all felt completely different.
But still something that you would see as like moral dilemmas, something like, I don't know, selfishness or...
Yeah, well, like, we'll see in how maybe like a player could, or maybe not even a player, maybe just how the video game character, if he's presented with different circumstances, becomes a different person based on his choices.
Mm.
Just like in the end of Bioshock 2, you know how like the little sister decides to do things based on how you've made those initial choices?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I would really like to see, rather than like having to make choices at every turn, to sort of like make a choice and then watch this character's entire life change because of that choice.
Yeah.
And to be able to see maybe like the different outcomes from there. So maybe, you know, he turns out to be a good person in one, or like a bad person or an ambiguous person, but at least, you know, you have an idea that he's not just like making these arbitrary decisions, that he's become the person he is because of
like a trajectory, rather than like, I'll consult the meter. Oh, I'm only 83% good. That means I can't do that.
Yeah. I really want to see, I want to see this sort of video game come to life, which is how I felt at the end of Bioshock 2.
I would like to see some moral decision-making in the MMOs.
Mm-hmm.
I think it'd be cool to see...
Like built into the quests, or just players being more active?
What I want to see is one player's moral decisions having a rippling effect to someone else's gameplay.
Mm-hmm.
I think it'd be interesting to see that play out. Hmm. You know, maybe if one group decided to kill the king... I'm thinking of a fantasy MMO for some reason, but
yeah.
in this world, if someone were to kill a king, if all of a sudden, you know, these first level players don't have guards because they can't fund the militia or something. Mm-hmm.
Man, that'd be a crazy undertaking.
Yeah.
You would need, like, Richard Garriott to, like, come in here and, like, make something. I think for me, I'm just more interested in seeing how the decisions... I'm just interested in seeing Team Ico's next game. Because they've made these games where there's a definite moral statement in all of them, and yet the player has no choice in it other than to either play or not play the game.
Mm-hmm.
And now that we live in a video game climate where it's all about choice, and a lot of games are just hewing more and more towards player options, it'll be interesting to see if The Last Guardian will give the players any kind of choice, or whether they'll stay with like a single narrative about a philosophical issue, but that in which the player has no huge choice in.
Yeah.
Because I think that can be equally as important, I guess, as player choice. Because it's rare that a designer will focus on communicating a message rather than letting the player kind of make up their own message.
Yeah.
And that's like that team who makes those games are very unique in that respect, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. All right. I think we're all moraled out for the day. Yeah. What do you think, guys?
I'm going to go, hurt some children or something.
Before we go, we should thank Andrew for being on.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Andrew.
Always nice to have a third chair. Tell people, I don't know, maybe a website or blog or anything that you want Twitter. Them to go see, that you write.
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, I really got to say it's been great talking with you guys. Thank you. And I want to thank you guys again for helping me out with that article that I was writing about a month ago.
Yes. Forthcoming. Everyone's getting a sneak peek. Andrew's writing something about war, video games, a little bit of ethics thrown in there.
It'll be interesting. I'm looking for a publisher for that. So once that looks like it's going to be published, I'll
let us know.
Yeah, guys. Very nice.
So the column is Design Diversions, and that's on Gamasutra and Gameset Watch. And the blog is Mammon Machine, as in the Chrono Trigger boss.
Got it.
Oh, yeah. We're there.
Nice. Yeah, I got a big picture of him on my front page. That blog is never updated, so look forward to design diversions, and especially that, since that's where most of my work is. Maybe if people start reading my blog, I might start updating it more.
So incentive.
So it's up to you, people. The power is in your hands to provide more work for Andrew to do.
That's right.
Bring it on, please.
All right, and with that, thanks everyone for listening. Andrew, thanks again for coming on.
Great to be here.
And everyone, take it easy.
Yeah. So long.